This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. A month after the killing of George Floyd while in police custody in Minneapolis, and everything that has happened since, both here in the Chattanooga area and across the nation, where do we go from here? That's a question I heard yesterday during a discussion that included two scholars on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Chandra Ward is assistant professor of sociology here at UTC, and Jonathan McNair is the Ruth S. Holmberg professor of American music. I spoke with them and with Marcus Ellsworth, artistic manager at Barking Legs Theater here in Chattanooga, as well as an activist and organizer.
Chandra, Jonathan, Marcus, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
I wanted to know your thoughts on what you've seen across the country, what you've seen in this area, what you've seen on campus. Things are being talked about, certainly, but I wanted to get more of a sense from you all how you're all looking at where the dialogue is and where it may not be at this point.
For me, I think, as people have mentioned, this moment seems qualitatively different than similar moments in my lifetime, at least. I went to protests when Black Lives Matter began in the wake of Ferguson, and the conversation seemed to be much broader. Going back to what Jonathan mentioned before we began recording about systemic racism in every aspect of American culture, because it is in every aspect of American culture, I think this is the first time we've really engaged in grappling with that instead of just focusing on police brutality and what type of reforms that can be made while keeping that system in place. I'm finally hearing conversations about the structure of white supremacy in every aspect of our culture and society.
Some of the people I follow on Twitter are addressing white supremacy built into the structure of classical music. That's kind of where I live most of the time in my creative life, though I certainly have interests beyond that and have influences from beyond that. But when concert repertoire is dominated by dead white men and orchestras for the longest time were dominated by white men, I mean, I could name off a page of black composers who have written and are writing excellent classical music, and yet they don't show up on concert programs typically unless it's February, Black History Month. Mm-hmm. If then, why not normalize the fact that these were highly creative, highly talented people who made great art and put it out there for everybody to hear and appreciate? And that's just one little corner that you might not think would be a bastion of white supremacy, and yet in ways that it is.
Well, and I think this moment that we're in right now is markedly different because people are more engaged than they have been before. But I think it's also partly to do because of the pandemic, because you have people who are out of work. They are struggling more than ever. They're seeing that these systems fail people, consistently fail people, and they're disenchanted with America. Because if this was the greatest country in the world, then why are so many of us struggling to get by? Why are we watching businesses shutter for good? Why is there no relief program for the people? This compounds with then what happens to George Floyd. And always, I think, been on a lot of people, the back of a lot of people's minds, but they just didn't have the bandwidth to really engage and confront it. So now this happens, the latest nationally covered and brutal, and like absolutely brutal murder of a black man in broad daylight in the street over ultimately $20. And so now people are engaging it, seeing this. They're no longer buying into the propaganda of what this country claims to be. They're now questioning it. They're now confronting it. This is, of course, primarily about racial injustice, but I think because of other injustices being carried out in this country, especially in the past 4 years, people are more open to actually engaging and seeing things like, oh, maybe we do need to explore abolishing police and mass incarceration and get rid of privatized prisons and reinvest into black and brown communities that have been demolished and held back by this country for so long.
Your sense of this moment is it is different than what's come before, but it's only the beginning of whatever actions are taken. We've seen some actions taken here, there, and everywhere, but I reckon from our conversation so far, that's just to begin to set the table.
We desperately need, as a nation, to be willing to engage in extremely uncomfortable conversations that are going to be really troubling and very painful. And if people are willing to go through that, we'll, on the other side, end up in a much better country and we'll feel better about each other. We'll feel better about ourselves if we're able to engage with those difficult conversations and look sincerely deep within and do the work that's necessary in ourselves. Been there, done that. I know I've got more to do. And it hurts, it's painful, it's uncomfortable, and it's rewarding and enriching, and it's worth it. That's what we need, but it's not going to happen overnight. People are going to have to, A, sustain pressure on elected officials from the national level to the state and local levels. We're going to have to put pressure on them to force them to do what they may feel is politically unpopular and to get over their fear of being freaking not elected. Do the right thing for the American people. Let's go for the greater good. That's what they're hired to do. And they consistently refuse to do it. That's what we need. And it's going to take sustained pressure, and the people of the United States are going to have to be patient, which will only happen if they start seeing real progress and if they see real investment in the work that's necessary. If people don't see that, they're going to get impatient real fast.
I think we're at the point of impatience. We're at the point where, yeah, people are fed up. I think we're to the point now where it's like, well, how many? How many Black people have to be shot in their home while sleeping? How many have to be knelt on for almost 9 minutes? How many kids have to be shot in the back playing with a toy gun in a park? How many of us have to wind up in prison for drug charges and then having a state turn around, legalize the charges that we were put in jail for, and then not letting us go? How many more different ways? How much more redlining? How much more employment denial issues? How many more housing issues? We're past being impatient. That's what this is. This moment is the system has failed the people to the point where now there is no more patience. And the action needs to come now. I mean, it's why city council is catching so much heat right now over their budget, because they're telling everybody, oh, well, trust the process and go through the process and this, that, and the other. Now, truth be told, people have been challenging the city budget for years, especially around policing and trying to defund the police and bringing up the abuse and the waste of funding and all these other things. This is not a new idea for city council. And then they wonder why people are getting mad and trying to drag on their comments for hours and protesting them and saying all these terrible things about them. It's because patience has passed.
And I think to Marcus's point earlier, I think this happening with in conjunction with COVID-19, has created an environment that is ripe for something new, something different, meaning that it seems like we've been saying this for the past 4 years, but this is unprecedented times. And with this social instability of COVID-19 and how it's changed our lives, on top of the systemic racial phenomena that's happening, it seems like we're getting a different response from society, not necessarily from our politicians, to Jonathan's point. But if people are tired, you have this social instability coupled with a new generation, and it speaks to Dr. Martin Luther King's last book, Where Do We Go From Here? That's where we're at. Where do we go from here? And where do we go from here? I think everyone's energy is, we cannot go back. I feel like our society will be marked as pre-2020 and post-2020. I've lived long enough to see this kind of thing of Black death in the hands of police many times. I was alive during the Rodney King verdict and unrest. This collective trauma on top of COVID-19 is forcing people, like, we cannot go back. We know what reform means. Reform at this point is just coded language. Okay, we've seen reforms. There were reforms after Ferguson. There was an inquiry, okay, the Ferguson Commission. There was body cameras. Well, apparently police turn them off, or even if people are recording, they'll shoot you anyway. Because obviously there's something fundamentally wrong, rotten even, with the institution of policing that is dated back to its origin. And again, going back to Jonathan, dating back to the origins of this country. And we cannot fix, change, solve anything with bandages. We are all thirsting for something qualitatively different in this moment, not reforms. We're asking ourselves, where do we go from here? We are thirsting to create something different that I believe, or at least I'm hopeful, will be created in this post 2020, in this 2020 and whatever happens in the future moment. Because something has to change. And that's, I think, what you're hearing in the street. Everybody's quoting Dr. Martin Luther King these days for a variety of purposes. And, you know, rights is the language of the unheard. Well, obviously we've not been heard. It is up to us to imagine something different, because the state, our trusted officials, don't seem to have the imagination to create something different. So that has to come organically. And I think that's what you're seeing, this organic creation in the streets of imagining a different society, a different way of being. And it comes out of desperation.
If anyone's familiar with how movements tend to grow and tend to, the phases they tend to go through, we're in the phase now where the visionaries are stepping forward. We're in the phase now where the artists and the civically minded people and the people who look at how laws affect us and policy, those are the people who are going to keep moving more and more to the forefront. And those are the people that we should really be paying attention to and engaging the ideas and the tactics that they're putting forward.
All right. Chandra, Jonathan, Marcus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Lee Smith is a New York Times bestselling author whose new book is titled Blue Marlin. On Sunday at 3 p.m., Southern Lit Alliance here in Chattanooga will host what it calls a book and a bottle event on Zoom, where Lee will talk about her book. I spoke with Lee and Linda Levan of Southern Lit Alliance.
Linda, Lee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Linda, tell us how you connected with Lee to have her come to Chattanooga, to the audience in Chattanooga, albeit virtually.
Lee is a member of the Fellowship of Southern Writers, so we have been connected with her through that organization and the literary festival that we do with them. So when I heard that she had just released a new book, I just made contact with her and asked if she would be willing to come on and help us do this event, which is part of continuing our mission, but it's also going to be a bit of a fundraiser for our organization to get through this tough time. We do feel like books are more important than ever for people to help cope with things that are going on, reach some understanding through others' eyes, and just really escape. And I know books are definitely picking up and people are reading more and finding it again.
And Lee, you are from Virginia, Southwestern Virginia.
Grundy, Virginia.
Tell me how you got into writing.
Actually, I'm not so much of a writer. I think it's a storyteller. I was lucky enough to grow up in a big storytelling family. I just come from that part of the country. Very like East Tennessee, maybe a little more mountainous where I'm from, Grundy, Virginia. But stories, even when I'm writing, still today, they come to me in a human voice. And most of them are actually written from the first person. I don't know. And it's a family of big talkers in politics, yellow dog Democrats, all of them. So I was just very lucky to come up in this kind of tradition. And my father ran the dime store in town, and I spent a lot of time down there, and I heard a whole lot of other kinds of stories down there. And he ran his dime store for 55 years. My grandfather was a county treasurer for 40-some years. So I was just very much a town kid, and I was soaking in all kinds of stories from all kinds of people.
Your novel that you're going to talk about is not set in Virginia. It is in Key West. It's called Blue Marlin.
That's right. In fact, if you had to find a place that would be the complete opposite in every way of Grundy, Virginia, it would be Key West. But oddly enough, there's quite a kernel of truth to this little novel, which makes it, for me, very emotional. I'm so happy that it's been published. I'm so happy to have it out there now, because it's really, I've always felt that I could tell the truth better in fiction than nonfiction. Real life is ornery. Sometimes things don't line up the way they should. The meaning escapes you. If you're stuck with the truth, sometimes you can't write as good a story. So this is actually based on a true life incident. Having mentioned Grundy, I will say this book is based on a trip that I took with my family in 1958 to Key West. And the circumstances of the trip were these, and they are the circumstances in the book. But the real circumstances were that both my parents had been ill. My dad had had a nervous breakdown. He was in a mental institution in Silver Hill, Connecticut for most of 1958. My mom had had a similar type of an incident, and she'd been in another hospital in UVA in Charlottesville. So I'd been farmed out to relatives and so on. And then came the time when both were better. Our nervous little family was going to get back together. And Daddy's psychiatrist at the time, who was brilliant, he prescribed not only lithium, the new great drug, but also what he called a geographical cure for the marriage, for the family. We were all going to get back together, but we were going to take a long trip together, instead of just resuming our life the way it had always been, which was kind of hard. So that's what we did. And I got to be, at age 12, a part of the geographical cure. So my daddy picked Key West because he had been stationed in the Navy there, purser on a destroyer, and so on. And he always loved it. So we get in the big fishtail Buick in Southwest Virginia, and we head for Key West in January 1958. They're not really speaking in the car. There's a lot of silence or things like, there's a cloud of cigarette smoke. Everyone's smoking, not me. They're smoking, and my mother's only saying things like, Lee, would you please ask your father to stop for some more cigarettes, even though he's sitting next to her. So things were not going great. Did not go great all the way down Wickiwatchee Springs, the whole shebang. But then we get to Key West, the brightest, pinkest, wildest sort of place I'd ever seen. And we go in the hotel, Blue Marlin's the name of the hotel, and my father goes in to check in, and he comes back out looking funny. And we said, what's the matter? And he said, girls, you're not going to believe this. And we said, what? And he said, well, we're going to be the only real people in the motel here, regular people. And the motel said, what? And he said, yes. He said, this whole motel has been taken over by the cast and crew of a movie they are now shooting in Key West named Operation Petticoat. And Mama said, are there any movie stars here? And he said, well, yes. And we both said, who? Because we read movie magazines cover to cover all the time and went to the movie every time it changed once a week in Grundy, Virginia. So, okay, we said, who? And he said, well, let's see. They said Tony Curtis. And we go, Dina Mero. And he said, who else? Cary Grant. And we just went, oh, like this. And so my mother immediately perked up, I got to say. And we were there. We were there for 2 months in this motel while they made the movie, and a lot of other things happened too. But there was a mood of chance, of difference, of change. Everything was bright. It was tropical. And pretty soon Mama started, she's a beautiful woman. She started wearing a hibiscus in her hair and little high heel shoes. And, you know, the upshot of it was I went back to Grundy, Virginia at the end of the geographical cure. Daddy ran his dime store for 33 more years, and they were together forever. It was a wonderful experience. I've changed it up a little bit, because when you write fiction, you often up the ante a little bit. In this book, Blue Marlin, the reason for the separation is fathers had an affair. That was not true in my family. They had just both been off on different paths getting themselves together. You know, but so it's a little more dramatic in the book, and the parents are not my actual parents, but the little girl is a lot like the obnoxious child I truly was. And I had fun, lots of fun, I mean, getting back to her voice.
You didn't stay at Ernest Hemingway's place in Key West, did you?
We didn't stay there, but we went. everybody gets to go because, you know, it's open to the public now. It's not very far from where the Blue Marlin Motel was, actually. But a lot of real events happened that were wonderful. One funny incident that's actually in the book was, you know, they didn't used to have, in 1958, you didn't have telephones in your rooms. You had a public phone in the lobby, that's it. So Mama and I soon found out that Tony Curtis called his wife, Janet Lee, on that phone in the lobby every evening at 6 o'clock. And we settled ourselves on this little settee sort of thing in front of a big fern so he couldn't see us, we hoped, to listen to every word that he said to Janet Lee every time they called. And so we put up big newspapers, like we were reading the paper, right? We listened to the whole conversation. It went on and on. And at the very end of every time, he would say, "God bless you, my darling." And Mama and I would go, newspapers, just like that. And we listened every night. And then finally, he was really nice. He gave me some nabs one time, these little cheese crackers, and I saved them. You know, I think I probably still have them.
And this experience in the novel that flows from this would be a few years before Janet Lee is in the movie Psycho by Hitchcock.
Yes.
And we're also a reminder that Tony Curtis and Janet Lee were the parents of Jamie Lee Curtis.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this movie, Operation Petticoat, frankly, is one of the worst movies ever made. But we got to be in it. We're in it. Me and my little troubled family, we're in it. And we're waving goodbye, goodbye to the pink submarine, a real pink submarine out in the bay in Key West when it leaves. And then we're waving hello, hello, like this when it comes back. The whole thing was the most memorable kind of experience. You know, sometimes you fall into something that is just completely outside your regular life. And I think that's what that psychiatrist was looking for. And the geographical cure worked.
Linda, that's part of what bringing Lee virtually here is all about right now when it comes to reading and being able to just step outside of yourself, especially after how much time during lockdown and wondering what's going to happen next?
Yes, this is the third author that we'll have virtually, and it's been very successful. And it's an important part of our mission to encourage people to be passionate readers and writers. So while we can't do some of our events, we have really been creative and done things in some different ways and are still going strong on making those literary experiences available to people. And we're doing a virtual creative writing workshop for teens this summer. Our Yahoo Fest, which is also a young adult genre for teens, is a festival. Can't do that in September, but we're doing it virtually. So we are really experimenting with that. And we are, the event is free online, but we suggest a donation and have some signed books if they make a donation and some bottles of wine, especially for Blue Marlin. And they're going to have some fun with it so that when they give, they get something fun in return, as well as the knowledge that they are really supporting literature and expanding it and showing the importance and the value of it.
And where can people go online for more information and to participate?
It's southernlitalliance.org. And you will see right on the front page, it's called A Book in a Bottle with Lee Smith. They can click on that. And we are asking for registration. So after that, our register, we will send them the Zoom link. We're going to be doing that on Zoom. That way they can participate.
All right. Linda, Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And I should mention, after our conversation, Linda Levan invited me to help host the virtual event with Lee Smith on Sunday at 3 p.m. Again, more information at southernlitalliance.org. For those of you who join us on Zoom, look forward to seeing you then. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Colleen LaLiberté is a storyteller who lives, breathes, and shares many forms of art, as a performer, director, writer, and puppeteer. She has worked with children at Siskin Early Learning Center here in Chattanooga as a professional learning coach and teaching artist, in a learning residency through the Wolf Trap program at UTC's Southeast Center for Education in the Arts.
Colleen, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Ray. It's my pleasure.
Tell us what teaching in and through the arts means to you.
Teaching in and through the arts, to me, means really being aware, using all the skills of the artist, which I think are predominantly being aware of what we all have as our human birthright in terms of creating, but creating meaning through the arts. For me, storytelling, our lives are stories, very rich. Human beings are incredible creatures. So, and we're full of stories. And how do we express what gives meaning to our lives, right? Whether that's making a drawing or creating a play, writing a poem, singing a song. It's so full. There's so much there, so that when someone says, okay, so what does it mean to be teaching in and through the arts? Well, to use a vehicle, a way to get to the things that are meaningful to us, whether that's something that we're dealing with that's joyful or something that has made us sad. There's so much to learn. How do we get to it that's beyond words? Because not all of our learning is happening just by what we read in a book. So to me, it's about using the arts as a vehicle to get to the things that are meaningful to us and how we make connection. So art and, I would say, like art and love and kindness. To me, if you can get someone that you're interacting with, and this is whether you're teaching to a child or whether you're connecting to an adult, you know, someone you're trying to understand, we're trying to make meaning in our lives. How do we connect? How do we make that connection? And with kids, it's like they are my greatest teachers in terms of the arts. They are. I mean, I love it. It's like, okay, guys, are we going to make a show? Let's make a show today. Okay, great. Who's going to be in it, right? And then that's all you need. You just need that one little prompt. And what kind of adventure are we going to have? If you think kinds of things that children love to do, we all love that, right? And I see that you're smiling. This is on radio, but I can see you, Ray, and I can see this big smile on your face because, yes, who doesn't want to go on an adventure? Right? You want to be the hero of your own story. So are you going to write about it? Are you going to make a dance? Are you going to sing? I've seen the most amazing, you know, friends will send me like little videos in this time where we can't be together. And they're like, hey, here's Eamon. This is his dance he created. He's just out in the driveway and he's just doing his thing. Right? And I'm like, that's so awesome, Eamon. I want to go, tell me about that. Who are you? Like, what is this dance about? Can you tell me about it? Or do I just have to watch it and, like, take it all in? So there's a lot there. Yeah, find that passion, that curiosity, what makes us delighted. And if you look at kids are pretty delightful creatures. I learn a lot from being with kids and watching kids. We do this all the time. We'll set up, I don't know, maybe we're making a fort in our living room. We're playing a game where the floor is water and we have to get across it, or just lots of different scenarios where we're playing.
I think the people who are listening to this can see us smile on the radio.
Okay.
Just a guess.
I hope they can. I hope they can feel that. I hope they can feel that because to me it's like, what do we do today? It's hard for people, right, to be not connected. So how do we use the arts? And I think the thing is to not think about that word art as something that you're making, but that it's a verb. Art is a verb. It's an action. Like love is an action. To me, they're connected. Some of my greatest teachers, you know, I was going back on, wow, how am I going to talk about this, right? Who are my teachers? Like Keith Johnstone, great improviser, and Claudia Cornette, whose book, Creating Meaning Through Literature and the Arts, and Eric Booth, The Everyday Work of Art. Talks about art is a verb, making connection. If you and I are in a scene, let's just say we're in an improv scene, right? My only job in the scene is to take care of you. You're my partner. I'm going to make you perfect. Anything you do, I'm going to love every idea that you have. And I don't have to be afraid if I'm on stage with you because I know that you have the same contract with me. whatever I do, you're going to make me right. You're going to make me perfect. So together as partners, we're going to navigate whatever story we're creating, because I'm going to take care of you and you're going to take care of me.
And you bring that to whatever art that you verb, whether we're talking about improv or you're talking about music, you're talking about dance, you're talking about theater, you're talking about puppetry. You are well-versed in all of these things and you bring them all together, whether teaching somebody else one-on-one or in a class or as a teaching artist, as you have been with Siskin through Wolf Trap and UTC.
Right. Thank you. I try to always in every situation look to my partner, whether it's a child I'm working with, the little person who's right in front of me, what lights them up? What is the thing that we have done that they're like, yes? And when they go, oh, I get it. And that's what's so exciting. My son recently was posting on Facebook. He said, okay, this is for my three-year-old. How do you draw a face? How do you draw a face? Share with me your story in a video, because it's for a three-year-old. He's not going to be able to read something. And he said it was so great because he took all these, he's an improviser too, but he took all these different ways. Everybody had a different way. They were, how do you draw a face? Some people were doing it with food and some people were doing it with objects and somebody was drawing. He said in quiet time, well, she's three, quiet time, she went away and she said, Daddy, you know, it's supposed to be like nap time. I want to draw a face. Can you bring me some paper and pencil? She wanted to practice, right? Draw a circle of the head, draw another eye. It's like she took those things, all those different ideas, and it's like processing it. That's what art does. It gives us an opportunity to practice, practice, practice. Who cares if you mess up the first time? Keith Johnson used to say, we were sitting in a class and they go, so lean in here. We say, I'd be like, so Colleen, have you ever done this before? And I'd be like, no. He goes, oh, so there's absolutely no reason you should be any good at it, is there? So, you know, it gives us a chance to practice. Let's practice stuff. Let's have fun and see you're smiling and laughing. That's what we want. Something that makes us laugh. Something that lights us up. Something that says, I get it. I hear you. I see you. I'm connected to you. And once we're connected, then we can go on a journey anywhere. As a teaching artist, I'm like, so what are you interested in? Should we play with these little guys and make up a story? What are we learning about? Are we learning about friendship and how to be kind? Well, let's make up a story about that. I have a little puppet. Oh, and she wants to be your friend, but she's a little shy. She might not want to come out right away. So how can you get her to come out? I don't know. Her name's Molly. Can you come out, Molly? And pretty, I'm telling you, within 2 seconds, you know, you have a flood of children or even adults that come around and go, oh, I want to meet this little person. Well, she's kind of shy. Can you say something? I'm a little sorry, could that say something to make me come out, right? So they might, you know, then they're going to say, please come out. I want to be your friend. Make it in a little song.
And this is the journey that you take children on at Siskin.
Right, absolutely. And to understand that they are all little people, children, very, very small children, have incredible capacity to understand the world. And that's their job. Their job is to make sense of the world. If we can go back and remember what it's like to try to experience something for the first time. Here they are with their group of friends. They know these people. They're new. They're making friends. They're learning how to navigate the world. We have some ways to help us in the classroom, whether it's sitting in a circle or being on our spot. How do we focus? Yeah, so the work I did to Siskin was really wonderful. I loved working with the teachers, and they already have a great paradigm for using the arts. I mean, it's very common as people are going down the hall, I'm hearing teachers, they're singing a song about going in the line. You know, here comes another group, and we got the train. Everybody on the train, we're getting ready to go outside. Okay, oh, pull on the brake. Here we are. Okay. She's going to call your name and get off the train. You can go out on the playground. So it is about that imaginary, that wonderful, vibrant. I mean, the world is a big, wide, expansive, colorful, exciting place to be. That's, as a teaching artist, to imagine every day going on this journey with this love and this excitement and being excited with them. Like, wow, look, you know, here, Zach, my son, I keep talking about it, but he shared another video. It was like, here came a snake. There was a snake coming towards them. And he didn't panic. It was a black snake. He's like, wow, look at him. He's beautiful. And you hear Zeta, who's three, like, well, what does he want? He's coming right towards us. I think maybe he wants food. Does he have teeth? Yeah, I think he has teeth. Wow, he's long and long and long. I mean, you know, it's like, look at the world and see everything. The opportunities are just boundless. They're so wide and vast. As a teaching artist, it's like, to me, one of the most natural things to do. I think everybody is a teaching artist. If we view ourselves that way, parents who are home with their kids and like, oh no, I don't know what to do. When you don't know what to do, look to your partner. I don't know what to do. How can, whether that's a child, what can we do together that will make our day an adventure? What are we interested in today? And then just follow that, see where it goes. It's like you have a little treasure map, right?
Because while it may involve performance, it's really all about discovery.
It's all about discovery. Every single thing that we do is about discovery. When you talk about learning, what is learning? Learning is discovering something. And then if you want to become really good at something, first of all, you have to find out about it, right? So you have to introduce ideas. Kids are looking, they can look in their environment, find all kinds of things that they're curious about. Parents can just look around the house. I mean, you don't have to have a stage. There doesn't have to be a special time when you're like, okay, now we're going to do art. If you view that your whole life is an artistic process, that to me is the main thing. And as a coach, as a learning coach, what I really try to do is say, let's just focus on what delights you. Like, what lights you up? If we're going to go on an adventure, if I'm going to take Ray Bassett on a storytelling adventure, like, well, what comes first, right? Oh, you know, we find a boat. Okay, great. Well, what comes next? We get in the boat. What comes next? We head towards an island. What comes next? We see a shark. Nope, we don't want to. Or yes, whatever. But, you know, we want to take an adventure. We want to discover something that really lights us up and then magnify that and let people see it. It's a way for people to see who we are and for us to be able to really see who other people are too. And children in particular, you know, my main focus with being a learning coach and teaching is to be with teachers or parents, to be with them and to be with kids and say, how can we make this a magical adventure and discover whatever it is? If we're learning something in nature, we're learning something about science or literature, or we're creating something. I mean, I have tons of like kid art that we make. I'm a big letter writer too. I love to write letters.
What's next?
Right now, we're really trying to navigate how can we survive this time that we're in, right? Which we all have the need, or one of our primary needs, of course, is to be loved. And we want to connect to people. And there are lots of people that are feeling disconnected and isolated during this time where we have to be apart from each other. So as an artist, I'm really looking for how can the art that I see every day can find a way to connect to people in communities, all communities, when lots of people are, you know, in all different kinds of stresses and pain and uncertainty, and we want to connect. So for me, I'm trying to navigate, how do I do that? How do I reach out and connect to people and use this art? I mean, we have this platform, right? The radio is great. We can hear each other. People can get on Zoom meetings and see each other, and that's terrific. So for me, trying to navigate, how do I do that? You know, do I make big puppets that I'm going to put in parades? Do I have some sort of outdoor performance? Am I going to go down the street in a costume and put signs out and say, okay, when you come by my house, you do an impersonation of your favorite, you know, animal or dinosaur, or, you know, how do we connect from far away? Trying to navigate. Why, normally at this time of year, I'm doing camp, directing children's theater camp, and do a big puppet camp extravaganza where we make puppets and write stories. And that's really fun and exciting because we're like, okay, we have like 25 characters. How are they all connected? Because kids will come and say, I know what I want to make this year. We have a dog and we have a dinosaur and we have a robot and we have a sea creature and we have all these different things. How do we connect them? And kids are great at making those connections about what's important to all these people, what's important to everybody. We all want to be safe. We all want to be loved. We all want to have friends. So every story usually has, like, there's somebody, for some reason, he's misunderstood, doesn't have a friend, and then all the characters that the kids create. Like, and they're amazing at the ways they decide they're going to make connection and be friends. So yeah, what's next? That's a really good question, Ray. I would like to know. I'm looking at you. What's next, Ray? What is next? What is the next thing that we're going to do that says, we love you, world, and we want to make sure we're all safe and connected and being delighted by things?
Well, we'll both have to figure that out.
Yeah, I guess so.
Where can people go online to follow everything that you do?
They can certainly send me an email. I do have a Facebook page, so they can find Colleen La Liberté. That's LaLiberté on Facebook. And Squawking Heads is my little company that I have. And that's SK Walking, like not skywalking. That's already taken, but but Squawking Heads has a Facebook page too. I have a web page, which is squawkingheads.org. We'll be updating that. We've had a big thing saying, camps, we're hoping camps will be this summer. Wait and see. But it doesn't look great with all of the rise in the numbers. You know, we want everybody to be safe, of course. So that's very sad for us that we're not going to be able to be connected to all of our kiddos with art experiences. But art is, I can't imagine anyone not thinking that they're an artist. I just, you know, you're a storyteller, right? You take things together and you make stories. And it's fascinating. People listen to you because human beings are interesting. And your life, I'm sure, is very interesting. And I would like to know more about your life sometime, Ray. Yeah, so that's being an artist and being a teaching artist is all about. Let's connect. Let's play. Let's have fun, even making sense of the things that are hard. There's a lot of things that are hard right now, and we want to stand with our friends, and there are lots of people doing very artistic things in order to express their way of being together and in solidarity.
Colleen, thank you so much for connecting here, albeit virtually, and connecting with our audience.
Hey, Ray, thank you so much for giving me the chance to ramble on about art and how much I love it. And I love it. That's just a big, it's a great big world, isn't it? It's a great big world.
We'll bring you more conversations with teaching artists such as Colleen and highlight the work of our UTC colleagues at the Southeast Center for Education in the Arts. More information at www.utc.edu/SCEA. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, Elena Nurabadi, Connor Brown, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.